derivatives. Who can tell me the x partial derivative of this polynomial? X cubed y to the fourth. Very good, very good. We hold that y constant. If you said that, very good. Right? I heard at least some of you saying that. 3x squared y to the fourth. If you hold the y constant, it's a constant multiple, so you just take the derivative of the x cubed factor. Leave the y fourth as it is. Okay, y partial derivative. Now we're going to have an x cubed as a constant multiple, so the derivative with respect to y, holding x constant, will be... Yeah, we're going to get a 4x cubed y cubed. 4y cubed from the derivative of y to the fourth, and x cubed as a constant multiple, or constant factor. Okay. And then you can plug in 2 and 2, and I think you get that. Right. A little arithmetic there. Okay, I claim these three numbers tell me, well, okay, these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 numbers tell me the tangent plane. 2, 128, 192, 256, right? The tangent plane approximation was that f of a plus some little change dx and b plus some little change dy is approximately the value at a comma b, right, without the little dx dy changes. And then you had to multiply by the partial derivative at your base point AB. So this is a ZX slope. That's how we're thinking of it. And ZX slope times change in X is the change in Z caused by the change in X. And then you have a ZY slope times a DY. So think of this as this product as the change in Z times the change in Z caused by Y. Okay. And so for us, okay, our Z is going to be F of XY, and our X is going to be the A plus DX, right? Because we're thinking of some point not at the base point, but probably a little bit off the base point. And what is A? A is 2. B is 2, right? That's our base point. And given that, if I have these top two equations here, what does that tell me dx is? If x is a plus dx and a is 2, I solve for dx and I get x minus 2. Yeah, that's the change in x from our base point if we're going from 2 to just x. dy is 1 minus 2. Okay. So we're going to have z equal to, and with the tangent plane itself, we, instead of, you know, an approximation of the actual curved surface, we make this an exact equation, and now it's not the surface anymore, it's the plane. Okay, so let's see. This is f at 2, 2. So this is the 128. This is the 196. This is the x minus 2. This is the 256. This is the y minus 2. Each of these things... plays its part. Okay. So that's what we were doing last time. Things like tangent plane approximations. Notice with the tangent plane, it's an exact equation, not an approximation. The curved surface is approximately a plane for dx and dy small. The plane, that goes out as far as you want. It's just not very close to the curved surface when you get far away. Okay. Now, we can look at this from another view. Okay. Another way to get the same thing. So you have this thing called the total differential. Where we take the x partial derivative times dx plus the y partial derivative times dy. And things will be as before, okay? At our particular point, this will be that slope of 192. And the dx will still be the x minus 2. That zy slope will still be 256. And the dy, that change in y on the tangent plane, is still y minus 2. And the only thing that's different is that I'm moving this term, the 128, to the other side of the equation. See, this dz or df, we're thinking of this as a change now in height on the tangent plane. So all I did was move the 128 over to the other side. So it's another way to get the same thing. And I bring this up because the total differential is helpful for understanding the chain rule. It's this idea that says the change in your output z on the tangent plane, right, which is only an approximate value compared to the actual change in height along the curved surface, is equal to your zx slope times change in x plus zy slope times change in y. Now, if you think back to calculus 1 and the chain rule, there's actually a similar phenomenon. Okay, so here's one version of the chain rule. This is the version that is what you have when you're doing some formula computation, right? You want the derivative of f of g of x with respect to x, and you get this ugly looking thing here, right? F prime applied to g of x multiplied by g prime applied to x. It doesn't look nice, but it actually matches what you write, okay? If I have, say, the sine of the logarithm of x, not that you'd ever use that such a strange function for anything I can imagine, but okay, the sine of the logarithm of x, okay, follow the chain rule, it works, right? We take the derivative of the sine, right? That's cosine, okay? No one's going to really write sine prime, they're just going to write cosine, right? That's the derivative. And then we have the g left alone, the inner function. And then we multiply by the derivative of the inner function, which is 1 over x. So this matches what we usually do with a formula. But conceptually, you know, what does it mean? Why is it that way? You look at that ugly formula. Wow, it doesn't make any sense. You can get a little bit of an interpretation of it if you write something like this. Instead of this kind of notation, right, we have all the messiness there. You might write this as to sort of help you see what's going on. Right? Okay, think of it as how does a F change divided by a change in X, right? The rate of change here, an FX slope. What we think of it as an FG slope times a GX slope. Change in F divided by change in G times change in G divided by change in X. The DGs there cancel, right? So it all works out. And, you know, this... This is nice. And so you're saying, oh yeah, of course, the DGs cancel out. And as long as DG is not zero, this literally works. It still works even if DG is zero. You just have to have the correct definitions of it. And there's another way that this gets done, but switch the boards here. Okay. People don't just write that, they also will often think of it like this. They'll think of it as, okay, y is equal to a function of x, right? But we're going to break it up into two parts. We have a u substitution, right? Y depends on u depends on g, so we have this composition. Plug in x to g to get u, plug in that to f. Right? Plug in x to the logarithm, plug in that to the sine function, for example. And so you also see people write this. Dy dx equals dy du, right? The yu slope times the ux slope, right? Change in y divided by change in u, multiplied by change in u divided by change in x. The changes in u should cancel and equal the ratio of y change to x change. Technically, that's not defined if you have a du of 0, but with the right interpretation, it still will be true if you understand this as not a literal fraction, but as a derivative, right? And all of this becomes valid if you have the right definitions here, right? The dy or df, right, is defined to be the derivative of f at u times du. Wait, what's du? Okay, well, du is defined to be same thing as dg. It's the derivative of g at x times dx, right? And then you have to say that if the du is zero, okay, take the limit as it approaches zero or something like that. But the cleanest way to do it is just to get rid of all the fractions altogether. So don't worry about that a minute. But wait, what's dx? Well, dx here is whatever, any number, right? Any change in x, if it's small, you multiply by the derivative at your base point and get the approximate change in u. And if the change in u is small, you multiply by the derivative at the base point to get the approximate change in y. And if you forget about the curve entirely and just think about the tangent lines, then these are actual changes as you're going along a tangent line. You graph u versus x, you do a little change x, this is the change in u on your ux tangent line. You have a change U here, leads to a change Y here on your UY tangent line, where you graph U versus Y to get a graph of F. So the last thing, the initial input that you feed into the logarithm and then into the sine, it can just be whatever. It just any number. So for example, dx du along the tangent line, for the logarithm relationship, if say x is, if you start at say, x equals 2 as your base point, and then you move over to 2.2, I'm exaggerating the scale, but the point. And then you have, the logarithm of 2.2 on this. We're going to be somewhere like this. The logarithm of 2 is about 0.69, and then we're going to move over to the logarithm of 2.2, what is that? Very roughly 0.70, okay? Very, very roughly, okay. And so here we have part of a sine wave here. That's off like that. And again, there's the curve, but then there's also the tangent line. Okay. So there's your du, and then there's that dy as an actual change on the tangent line. And the way to rewrite it without any fractions would be to just write it like this. Dy is equal to f prime u du. But then du is equal to g prime x dx. So you put that together, and dy is equal to f prime of u times g prime of x times dx. Oh, but wait a minute. This u is g of x, so this is just f prime of g of x times g prime of x. And maybe if I just divide both sides by dx, I've got the derivative, and now I've recovered the ugly-looking chain rule formula. It's all the same thing. Okay. And in this interpretation, where there were no fractions, there was no division by zero until possibly the very end, where I divided by dx. But all the way through, until I start actually doing some division, if I'm using this formalism, no division by zero problems. Yeah. You have this kind of stuff, and okay, fine. Well, what does this have to do with calculus 3? Well, we have this total differential construct here, and that was for it was z was x cubed y squared, and so the total differential dz was the x partial derivative. Sorry, it was y to the fourth. Yeah. X cubed y to the fourth. And then 4x cubed y cubed with the dx's and dy's. So I could use this to get tangent planes at any base point. Now, I'm going to do a funny thing with this. Okay? I'm going to think about putting things in polar coordinates, okay? So we have z equals x cubed y to the fourth. This is some kind of curved surface. It's kind of flat near the origin, but away from the origin is generally pretty steep. Now, we could ask some questions about this thing in cylindrical coordinates or polar coordinates. What would happen if I was interested in, say, the thinking of z as a function of r and theta? And so I asked you, okay, if we think of z as a function of r and theta, what is the derivative with respect to r? And what is the partial derivative with respect to r? And what is the partial derivative with respect to theta? Okay. And all this kind of stuff that I was trying to make you think back to Calculus 1 about, right? You can do the analogous stuff in multivariate calculus. So, go. I'm going to write that formula again. But then I'm going to change everything up. So this was f of x and y. But now, and here was the differential. Total differential. Remember, this was the x partial, and then this was the y partial. Okay. And people will also write these things using this kind of fake fractional notation. And they'll also write it using z's, although this instead of the f, although that is a little bit more ambiguous. Anyways, I'm trying to emphasize more the subscript notation this semester, as it's more compact. And when you get big formulas with lots of partial derivatives, you end up using this anyway to save space. So I thought I'd go with that from the start. But you will see these other things. People will use them. You should be aware of them. Okay. And, in fact, there is kind of a fake fraction cancellation thing you can see in here, right? If you write it like this. Okay, so you can think of it as there's part of the, after you can't, if you pseudo cancel the partial x and dx, you have this partial z, and if you pseudo cancel the partial y and dy, yeah. Right, you get this other partial z, and they add up to the total change in z on the tangent plane. Okay. Now what I'm going to do now is move it to polar coordinates, like I said. So now I'm going to have x will be this function g, which you've seen before. What is it? It's r cosine theta, right? If you input polar coordinates into this function, you get the x coordinate out. And here's the function where if you input polar coordinates, you get the y function out, r sine theta. And we could bring this all together into one giant function, right? We could call it k of r theta, where I put everything together, right? We apply. It looks ugly when I write it this way. But this is what's going on. Plug in r cosine theta and r sine theta into x and y. Plug those into your function that gives you z. So yeah, this looks ugly. Okay, let's write it out. Right? What is it actually doing? R cosine theta gets cubed, and r sine theta goes to the fourth. Okay, and you can simplify this, right? And you could then you could proceed to directly compute the partial derivatives right from the formula, okay? So you could have your partial z partial r, right? Or in subscripts, you could also write it as the k sub r. And if you write it with all these other funny possible notations. Okay, that's not too hard, right? Okay, because the thetas are constant. So we get 7r to the 6 times all that annoying theta stuff, right? The understanding here is that we're taking the derivative with respect to r, but what are we holding constant while we do it? We're holding the theta constant. The problem with this notation is you have to have the context of what's the other variable. If you don't know what the other variable is, you can get in trouble. That's part of what I'll talk about in my Friday lecture on special relativity. Okay. So, fine. Now, there's a general pattern to this. Okay. So, we can compute total differentials for x and y in terms of r and theta. You just have to take partial derivatives. And if I plug these in, let's see what we get. Okay. So the r partial derivative of this is cosine theta. Then the theta partial derivative will be a constant factor of r times a negative r sine theta. Or sorry, just negative sine theta times an r. And if I take the partial derivatives of this one, that. And if you want now, you can take these things here and plug them in to the total differentials here. And I'll write it a couple of ways. One way to write it is, okay, this is partial y partial theta. This is in the fake fraction notation. Or partial y partial r. Yeah. Partial y partial theta is that one. This one is partial x partial theta. Yeah. All of it. Yeah. And this one is partial x partial r. Right? So in the fake fraction notation, what I will get is this as kind of the fractional analog of the chain rule with multivariable stuff. So we have that dz in this kind of fake fraction form is partial z partial x times partial, and there's going to be a big mess of stuff here. Plug in for the dx and you get partial x partial r dr plus partial x partial theta d theta. And then we get partial z partial y. And we have partial y partial r dr plus partial y partial theta d theta. This is the dx. This is the dy change. Okay. And if you then rearrange it by essentially grouping the dr terms and the d theta terms, this is what you get. This is taking a lot. I don't care what the schedule says. I'm going to talk about the chain rule on Thursday as well, because it's taking a while. Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to regroup it here.
What am I doing here? I'm grabbing all of the DR terms and putting them together. So here we have a DR term, and here we have a DR term. And you can see how they ended up here. If you distribute, you have partial z, partial x from here times all this dx stuff, but it included this DR term. So I grab that term and put it here. Partial z, partial x, partial r, right there, times a dr. And then here's the other dr term. Partial z, partial y, times partial y, partial r, times dr. Goes down here. And then I grouped the d theta terms, right? So we have partial z partial x times partial x partial theta d theta. And that is right down here. And then we have partial z partial y times partial y partial theta d theta. And I have that right here. Partial z partial y partial theta times d theta. Okay, so. So I did this big regrouping, right? Just regrouped everything into the dr terms and the d theta terms. Okay. Why would I ever want to do that? Well, I think you should compare this to the total differential for this crazy function here, okay? If we reimagine z not as a function of x and y, but as a function of r and theta, then we get another expression for dz. Using this funny function k here. This. Now, what's going on there? When I think of z as a function of r and theta, I'm thinking cylindrical coordinates. Now I think of a change in dz, at least for small changes, it's approximately the zr slope times a change in r plus a z theta slope times a change in theta. And I have something over here that matches. Here I have something times a d times a change in r plus something times a change in theta. Okay. And these changes, dr and d theta, they can actually be any numbers you want. They're free inputs. There's two input variables, r and theta. You can change them however you want. So the dr and d theta can be just any numbers. And so the only way this formula can work for any numbers dr and d theta, and this formula can work for any numbers dr and d theta, is if they're actually the same. So this big thing here, that's partial z partial r. And this thing here is partial z partial theta. And you can check, like we computed here the 7 r to the 6th cosine cubed sine to the 4th. Does it match this? Let's see. I'm going to find out. Is this really my k sub r here? Is this really my partial z partial r? Let's see. partial z, partial x is known to us. Partial x, partial r is known to us. It is cosine theta. Partial z, partial y is known to us. It's 4x cubed, y cubed. And then partial y, partial r is known to us. It's negative r. No, it's just sine theta. Whole bunch of partial derivatives here. And if you put this together, you get 3 times r cosine theta squared times r sine theta to the fourth, plug in the cylindrical coordinates, times a cosine theta, plus 4 times r cosine theta cubed times r sine theta cubed times the sine of theta. And I claim that if we simplify this monstrosity here, I claim that it does actually equal that. These are actually the same thing. You might start to think I'm right. There's a 3 plus a 4. Yeah, it adds up to 7. Now, the most efficient way to compute this partial derivative in this case was just to substitute, right? Compose the functions, get the formula, take the partial derivative directly. Doing it piecemeal this way, it will get you the right answer, but it took longer. So for this problem at least, you know, okay, it's some kind of abstract pattern. It doesn't really help solve your problem if your problem is finding partial z, partial r. Okay. The way the pattern can become useful is when you don't have all the formulas, or the formulas can get too complicated, and all you really want is just some numbers, like you just want the derivative at a point. So that's where I'm going ahead with this. But I've filled the boards of all these patterns. So let me take some pictures. About some more of these patterns. Maybe approaching the time for me to buy a
Either a new memory card or a new camera.
Okay, so to summarize the pattern we had before, we were in this situation. We had Z was a function of these guys, right? And it, but let's make it slightly more general. Well, I have R and theta. It doesn't just have to be moving to cylinder coordinates. It could be any variable, so I'll just call them U and V. And so the pattern is, okay, if I want the change in u, or the rate of change, zu, we ended up with this formula. This is the analog of what I wrote before. It's the same as what I wrote before, except, see, right there, same thing, except I'm going to use a u instead of an r. This is a general pattern. And intuitively, what's going on there is that u influences both x and y, and then x and y influence z. So you have to have these two products. U influences x, which influences z, so that contributes to the zu slope. U influences y, which influences z, that also contributes to the zu slope. And similar, same thing if we wanted to have the V partial derivative, right? V, in this case, influences both X and Y. So we end up with this kind of formula. It looks exactly the same as this thing here, except instead of an R, it's a V. Now, there are many other patterns like this. There's basically two other patterns for functions of at most two variables. So this is kind of the big one in which you have three functions of two variables, f, g, and h. So if you only allow at most two inputs at a time, that's kind of your maximum complexity. There's some somewhat simpler cases. You have a function of just one variable, okay? And then it depends on, say, x and y. And we'll call this output u. So this is another pattern. Okay. And so in this case, we get partial z partial x is equal to, now z is just a function of one variable, so I can actually write a regular derivative, dz du, right? It's just going to be f prime there. Right? And then partial u partial x. And then I have dz du again times partial u partial y. And the picture here is that x and y both influence u, and u in turn influences z. Oh, wait, I'm missing. No, let's... Yeah, somebody wanted. So there's two of these. So you get the zx slope and zy slope like that. And then the third pattern comes up is z now is a function of two variables, but then But then those variables, they'll be x and y. They in turn depend on just one variable. So now the flow is there's an input t which influences x and y, which in turn influence z. And so if you want to ask, how does t influence z? Right? Now, ultimately, when you put this all together, there's just one input. T determines z completely, so it's just a regular derivative, not a partial derivative. So now we have two paths of influence. On the one hand, t influences x. So you have partial z, partial x here. Then you multiply by the xt slope. So t influences x, influences z. But then you also have t influences y influences z. Okay. So these are three patterns. In the first pattern, x and y influence u and v, which influence z. In the second pattern, x and y just influence u, which influences z. And then the third pattern, t influences x and y, which influences z. Okay. All right. So these are some patterns, and we'll take the test tomorrow. On Thursday, we will talk about some more examples in which we use these kinds of patterns. So no homework today. It took too long going through the background.